Arts of Time. Since last August, 7 months ago, Life's four big new presses have been turning out 100,000 additional copies every month. Last week, these presses reached another new high. 2 million copies of Life were printed and distributed to subscribers and news dealers throughout the United States. With 2 million copies a week, news dealers in many U.S. cities now have sufficient copies to last through the weekend. But still, from branch offices of the American News Company, Life's distributors, come requests like these. From Birmingham, Alabama.
Life sold out. Send more copies. Have enough for only two-thirds of our news dealers.
From Trenton, New Jersey.
Please let us have 30% more copies of Life.
From Springfield, Massachusetts.
Again, sold out on Life. Only 40% of our news dealers are getting copies.
From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Life sold out. Can use 20% more copies and still sell out 100%.
From 83 of the 100-odd American News Company branch offices came such telegrams this week. 2 million copies of Life, the news magazine of pictures. And still not enough to meet the nationwide demand. The new issue of Life is on sale tomorrow, Friday. Get your copy early, tomorrow morning.
Tonight, Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, joins Time, the weekly news magazine, in presenting by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time. Miles from London, off the King's Highway in Buckinghamshire, is the village of Speen. One day, 12 months ago, off a cobblestone lane in an ancient brick building, the Old Plough Inn, a distinguished oldster, Britain's one-time Labour Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, talks with a prim, apple-cheeked woman behind the bar, his daughter, Ishbel MacDonald.
I'm so glad you like my place here, Father.
Aye, it's a delightful inn, Ishbel. But the grounds around, the outside, you must do something there.
Oh, yes, I intend to. I'm expecting a man to come in this afternoon.
That's right. Draw me another pint, Ishbel.
Yes, Father. Then you really think...
You've learned the trick already, scraping the foam off the top.
Yes.
I wouldn't have thought you'd learn so quickly.
Begging your pardon, ma'am. I'd like to see the proprietor of the Old Plough.
I'm the proprietor of the inn.
Well, your place is certainly in bad need of a gardener, ma'am. I was noticing as
Thank
I come
you.
Up the...
But Mrs. McCormick is sending me a gardener this afternoon. A Mr. Ridgely.
Aye, that's my name, Ridgely.
Oh. Oh, I see.
Oh, I thought I recognized Mr. Ramsay. I'm proud to meet you, sir.
How do you do?
Have you had any experience in gardening, Mr. Ridgely?
Aye, and I'd say the first thing to do was to clear the weeds from the climbing roses. Choked they are.
Indeed.
I'm also a painter and an electrician. In fact, there's not much in the way of handiwork that I don't do.
But I don't want a painter or an electrician, Mr. Ridgely. I want a gardener.
No, Ishbel. The lad is the look of a gardener. You might be needing a man to fix things here and there.
Well, I know.
Well, thank you, ma'am. And Miss MacDonald, perhaps you'd rather call me what the village folk do.
Oh, and what's that?
Tinker, they call me, ma'am. Tinker Ridgely.
In the ensuing months, many a London celebrity finds his way to the obscure little village of Speen. Sees the daughter of one-time Labour Prime Minister of Britain hand out half pints across the bar. Note that gardener Tinker Ridgely spends more time assisting the proprietor behind the bar than in the garden. Then, one evening this week, in the raftered taproom of the Old Plough Inn, a throng of villagers stands grouped around the bar.
You say they've gone to London, Ross, but when?
This morning, early.
Did you take any luggage with her?
Well, I can't be discussing my employer's business, but I think she did take a bag.
Then it'll be surely today.
Well, draw me another one, Ross.
I could do with another myself.
Well, it's going to be fine for business, this romance. Maybe I'll exceed my quota on flour beer this month.
Wait, everybody quiet while I answer. Hello? It's London calling.
London? Be there. London?
Yes, Miss MacDonald, this is Ross. She says they've just left the city hall.
Left the city?
Did you so, Miss MacDonald? She says they've done it.
They've done it.
Yes, Miss MacDonald, I'll do that. Yes, goodbye and good luck. Yes, sir, they've done it. From now until closing, all drinks are on the house.
This week, Ishbel, the daughter of Britain's one-time prime minister, hostess of number 10 Downing Street for 3 years, once rumored engaged to Lord Arnold of Hale, once to Canadian Professor King Gordon, long and good friend of King George and Queen Elizabeth, in London's Hampstead Hall is married to her gardener, 34-year-old Norman Ridgely, known to the village of Speen as Tinker. Time marches on. New York City. The floor of the New York Stock Exchange as trading opens at 10 a.m. on Tuesday morning.
166.5.
As the market opens a routine recession day with steady bids and light selling, a slender gray-haired man makes his way across the trading floor, mounts the rostrum. The market gong rings and puzzled brokers look up, stop bidding as Stock Exchange President Charles R. Gay begins to speak.
Gentlemen, I regret to announce that the firm of Richard Whitney and Company is unable to meet its liabilities and is suspended from the exchange. A hearing will be held on the condition and conduct of the firm within a fortnight.
On the floor of the Stock Exchange, brokers fall silent as President Gay concludes his brief announcement of the first Stock Exchange failure of the Roosevelt Recession. The failure of Richard Whitney and Company. Richard Whitney, number one U.S. broker, youngest man ever to become president of the mighty New York Stock Exchange, leading exponent of the daring, colorful tradition of the financial giants of the 1920s, leader in the fight on government control of the exchange, known in Wall Street as the broker's broker. Recalled by the stunned, silent groups clustered around the trading post is the fateful Black Thursday of October 24th, 1929, when, with stocks headed by U.S. Steel plummeting downwards, the most potent financial leaders of the U.S. desperately confer, select Richard Whitney to go onto the floor of the exchange and make the one gesture that can rally the market, to buy and keep on buying until the flood of sales is stemmed. And a few moments later, on the floor of the exchange, Richard Whitney elbows his way through the frantic bidders around post number 2, the trading post of U.S. Steel.
2,000 steel, 194 asked.
191.5 bid.
Take it. Quiet, please. Quiet. Yes, Mr. Whitney, yes?
25,000 steel at 205. 25,000 steel at 205.
Do bid. Steel at 205. 205.
Thus, at 1:30 p.m. on 1929's Black Thursday, Richard Whitney made the amazing bid which was to make him a legend. Saved one day, but failed to save another, when steel in the U.S. market plummeted so fast and so low, no man could have stopped it. This week, Richard Whitney and Company files a voluntary petition in bankruptcy in federal court, with unsecured debts of more than $700,000. The actual extent of insolvency is yet unrevealed. Today, Richard Whitney is indicted by the grand jury of New York County on a charge of grand larceny. And with Wall Street tension at its most acute in 5 years, reminiscent of the black days of 1929, is a worn, tired man who slowly descends the steps of a townhouse in Manhattan's East 73rd Street, pauses to make a brief statement to waiting news hawks.
In the first place, I want to say that I alone am responsible for the failure of my firm, and I shall do everything in my power to prevent any of my clients from suffering losses through my actions. None of my partners had anything to do with the mistakes that were made. I fully realize that certain of my actions have been wrong, and I'm determined to meet the consequences, and I'm placing myself at the disposal of the district attorney.
Time marches on. New York City. As Manhattan's winter draws to its close, six stout, middle-aged men this week gather together, go out onto the streets to serenade Manhattan's polyglot population, the first harbingers of approaching spring. They are Professor Rupert Schmidt and his German band. At the corner of Columbus Avenue and 108th Street.
What do we play?
It's the Russian district. We play their new national anthem, the International. All right? One, two, commence.
Stop it! Stop that music! Reds, Bolsheviks, communists! Why don't you play the anthem for the Tsar?
But we...
Go away! Go on the way! Get out of here! Get out of here!
Flatbush Avenue, Brooklyn.
Well, a Jewish song, eh?
Rupert, I don't know. Now, maybe better just a waltz. The last time...
No. In this neighborhood, they like Jewish songs. You'll see this time. All right. One, two, commence.
Hey. What do you guys think you're doing?
Just... playing music?
Well, it's a residential district. You're under arrest.
Two minutes later, in the corridor outside the Flatbush courtroom...
The policeman says that this judge is Irish. Matthew J. Troy, his name is.
Rupert, you're not thinking...
Why not? An Irish tune we play.
Here? Right outside the courtroom?
Professor, it's a good idea. But it doesn't seem to work so good.
No. Now, this time, I am certain. All right, when Irish eyes are smiling...
Rupert, if we are wrong this time...
When Irish eyes are smiling. One, two, commence.
Hey! The judge wants to see you.
Oh, I knew it.
Right in here. These are the men, Your Honor.
We were playing for you, Your Honor, when Irish eyes are smiling.
For me, eh?
Yeah.
It was very kind of you. I remember how the German bands used to come out on the streets every spring, play the Irish melodies I love.
Yeah, that's just the way we do it, just like that.
Yeah. Well, I like music. Sentence suspended.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. You see, boys, what did I tell you? Now we thank the judge, eh?
All right.
By mere pistouchet, all right? One, two, come in.
Order! Stop them! Get them out of here! Get ready!
This week, wrong three times, but right once, Professor Rupert Schmidt and his German band are finally released with suspended sentences from Flatbush Court, on condition that in the future they refrain from playing on busy streets, residential districts, and the courtroom of Irish magistrate Matthew J. Troy. 1938, marches on. A fortnight ago, high up in the Sierra Nevada range near Calder, California, just at nightfall, in a cottage on the edge of a mountain pass, a small mongrel terrier sniffs at the door as Mrs. Winona Ferris buckles her overshoes, says goodbye to a friend.
Sure, you got everything, Winona. Your mittens and your scarf.
Yeah, I'm ready. Well, I better hurry along now. Goodbye, Mrs. Laurie.
My, snowing pretty hard. Don't you think you ought to spend the night here?
Oh, no, I'll be all right. Skippy will help me if it blows up anymore. Won't you, Skippy?
Well, button up tight.
Come on, Skippy. Come on.
Mrs. Winona Ferris lives a mile and a half away. She knows it always takes just half an hour to get home. But tonight the snow is heavy. High up above, the big white flakes are banking on the already thickly crusted slopes above the mountain pass where Mrs. Ferris and her dog are trudging home.
Skippy? Here, Skippy? That's right. Keep ahead of me where I can see you. A little hard to walk against the wind. So dark.
The snow on the little terrier's back has turned to ice. Mrs. Winona Ferris' steps are slower. Above, on the mountain wall, tons of snow are drifting, piling up, balancing delicately over the narrow path below.
We'll get there, Skippy. We'll get there. Yes, I'm coming, Skippy. I'm following.
Mrs. Ferris stops a moment. Stands under a hanging rock sheltered from the wind. On the face of the mountainside above the pass, an ice and snow-laden branch bends, snaps, and gives way. Tons of snow begin to move faster and faster toward the valley below.
Listen. Jimmy. Listen. It's the snow. Jimmy. It's a slide. Run, Jimmy. Run.
No light burns in Mrs. Ferris' cottage at the other end of the pass. A week passes, 10 days, and no word comes. Then on the 12th day, a searching party plows its way through the heavy drifts. A whining whimper breaks the silence of the canyon walls. 5 minutes later, near a hanging rock, the searching party comes to a mound of snow, finds a terrier dog, ice frozen on his back.
Here, boy. Here.
Half starved.
Come here, boy. It's all right.
Put the pup inside your coat, Joe. Have to go back for a sled.
This week, to a scrawny mongrel terrier at California's Swank Oakland Dog Show, the American Kennel Club gives a medal outranking every blue ribbon at the show. An award specially created for Skippy, who stayed beside the body of his mistress for 12 days in the snows of the Sierra Nevada mountains. An award given only for one point, loyalty. Time marches on. Washington, D.C.
The administration of the Tennessee Valley Authority is confused, extravagant, and secretive. As chairman of the TVA board, I demand that Congress investigate the whole project.
So this week, on the 5th anniversary of the first inauguration of Franklin Roosevelt, under fire from its own top man goes the project nearest and dearest to Franklin Roosevelt's heart. As wide open breaks a feud among TVA's 3 board members and administrators. Declares TVA's David Lilienthal.
Chairman of the TVA board, Dr. Arthur Morgan, is engaged in a campaign to discredit the board majority by obstructing every action it attempts. He has refused to cooperate with the majority's decisions and has even made deals with private utilities to discredit his colleagues. Chairman Morgan should resign his position at once.
Says Chairman Morgan,
I have no intention of resigning. The TVA is rotten through and through, and I'm going to see that it's cleaned up. I appeal to Congress to investigate both my charges and the charges of the board majority.
Promptly to the floor of the U.S. Senate uprises New Hampshire's Republican Senator H. Stiles Bridges.
Gentlemen, the TVA is the biggest and most dangerous New Deal project of them all. It's out to put 2 big private industries out of business. The fertilizer industry and the utilities industry. It may even result in the complete socialization of America.
Mr. President, if enriching the lives and the produce of 2 million American farmers be socialization, then I say let's have it.
The only people TVA has enriched so far have been grafters, bureaucrats, and politicians. Let's look at the Comptroller General's report. $15 million discrepancy in TVA's books during 1936 and 37.
I don't believe it.
Oh, I'm not saying anybody is a crook. But let me cite an example. The TVA needed a jackass to carry some supplies over a hill. Of course, they could have got a jackass right off the emblem of the Democratic Party, but they didn't think of that.
Hannibal used elephants. Why not the TVA?
So the TVA appointed a committee to find the jackass. After spending $2,086 for traveling expenses, they found the jackass and bought him for $2,500. They finally sold him for $300. A net loss to the U.S. Treasury of $4,280.
Even if the senator's story is true, I don't see what it proves about the TVA.
It doesn't take an anecdote to prove the TVA is a monstrous scandal. Who got that $15 million? The New Deal is helping the ill-fed, the ill-housed, and the ill-clad by putting out saucers of cream on the White House steps. Political cream for fat political cats.
Mr. President.
The senator from Nebraska, George Norris.
Gentlemen, I have spent many sleepless nights over the difficulties within the TVA. I am sick at heart over what's happened. But, gentlemen, the TVA is bigger than this sort of thing. In all great undertakings, there are evils, inefficiencies. Let them be corrected, but let them not destroy the TVA.
This week, Nebraska's veteran Senator George Norris makes an appeal for the New Deal's most ambitious plan, the Tennessee Valley Authority. A long-range program to reclaim a huge and potentially wealthy U.S. agricultural community by water, by soil enrichment, and by electric power. This week, TVA is winner in its biggest battle to date, as the competing private utility empire of Wendell L. Wilkie begins negotiations for its sale to the federal government. But this week, facing an investigation by Congress, the last of the major New Deal experiments comes to a standstill. And like NRA, AAA, and PWA before it, Franklin Roosevelt's most cherished dream of 5 years ago this week stands on the threshold of its trial by political fire. Time marches on. Berlin, Germany.
Turn me, Muller.
Yes?
The Fuhrer is expecting you. Follow me, please.
It is an evening 8 months ago at the headquarters of the Reich Chancellery, official headquarters of Adolf Hitler. A tall, burly man, middle-aged, stern-faced, follows a uniformed guard down a long corridor. The man is Martin Niemöller, one-time U-boat commander and war hero, famed pastor of Berlin's most fashionable church, and spearhead in the resistance of the German church to Nazi domination. Through a great paneled door strides the pastor and pauses inside.
Herr Niemöller, sit down.
Thank you, Herr Reichsführer.
I don't believe we have met before.
I believe not, Excellency.
Herr Niemöller, you had a splendid record in the World War. Allow me to congratulate you on your heroism.
You are very kind, Excellency.
You could still fight and win battles for Germany if you would, Herr Niemöller, from your pulpit.
I do fight battles for Germany from my pulpit, Excellency.
You preach against the National Socialist State, Herr Niemöller. That is treason.
Reichsführer, you preach against the established church and against your God. That is worse than treason.
The party and I, its leader, are trying to build a new Germany, a strong Germany. To that ideal belongs the first loyalty of every German. Well?
Excellency, I must continue to preach, as I have always preached, for 15 years.
Very well. Lieutenant.
Reichsführer.
Place this man under arrest.
At the personal command of Adolf Hitler, Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller goes to Moabit prison, accused of seditious misuse of the pulpit and treason to the Third German Reich. Then one day this week, after 7 months of imprisonment and 1 month of a trial conducted behind the closed doors of an emergency court, Martin Niemöller stands on the prisoner's dock before a German judge.
Martin Niemöller, this court finds you guilty of misuse of the pulpit as charged and sentences you to honorable detention in a fortress for 7 months. The court has decided, however, that inasmuch as you have already served more than that time in prison, you are hereby to be set at liberty on payment of costs.
One hour later, in the home of Martin Niemüller, his wife and seven children receive arriving guests.
Oh, Julie and Friedrich, come in. Come in. You are so kind to bring all these flowers. Martin will be so touched.
You should be happy, Frau Niemüller.
Oh, I am. I am.
How soon do you expect Martin, Frau Niemüller?
Oh, any minute. They tell me he left the courtroom a few minutes ago. Oh, he will be so glad to see you all again. Answer the phone, Martin, like a good child.
It will be like old times any minute now.
And after 8 months...
Mama.
Oh, excuse me just a minute. Yes, this is Frau Niemüller. Yes.
Who is it, Mama?
Hush, Otto. Yes. Oh, I see.
What is it?
Martin has been rearrested.
Rearrested?
They have sent him to a concentration camp.
But this week at Sunday service in the church of Martin Niemüller, still ringing out is the voice of another German pastor, speaking for the conscience of German Christians and German freedom.
To you who have gathered here to reaffirm that faith which is your rightful heritage as Germans and as men and women, I cannot hope to speak with the eloquence and vision of Martin Niemüller. But his spirit still speaks from this pulpit. The barbed wire fence of the concentration camp cannot suppress it. The harsh voices pouring out their unreasoned abuse on the heads of free men cannot suppress it. Those who would mold men's hearts of iron and their faith of blind, hypnotized fervor cannot suppress it. In Germany and throughout the world, the free spirit speaks more eloquently in silence than ever it did in words. It will not ever weaken. It cannot ever die.
This week on the same day, the 21 old Bolsheviks go on trial in Moscow for treason to the Soviet state and Joseph Stalin. In Berlin, Martin Niemüller goes to a concentration camp for treason to Adolf Hitler, with no official charge against his name. The length of his term, the future date of his release, unknown. Time marches on. Life, the big news magazine of pictures, was planned to appeal to every kind of American, old and young. And in the whole history of publishing, no other magazine has been so thoroughly and consistently read by every member of the family.
Every survey shows that each copy of Life is read by an average of more than seven people, the men and women and children of America's leading families.
Families like that of dynamic, hard-hitting Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia of New York City. Says 7-year-old son, Eric LaGuardia.
I like Life because I can read the pictures.
Says the mayor's 9-year-old daughter, Jean.
I like to read Life each week because it shows me so many things and I hear Daddy talking about.
Says Mrs. LaGuardia.
Life is one magazine that every busy woman should read.
Says Mayor LaGuardia.
As mayor of New York, I've got to be on the spot wherever things are happening to see firsthand what's going on in this town. I like Life because it makes me feel as if I were on the spot wherever big things are happening in the world, actually seeing them with my own eyes.
The family of Mayor LaGuardia of New York is just one of the nearly 2 million American families that will read each page of the new issue of Life out tomorrow. Be sure to get your copy from your news dealer tomorrow morning, early. Time marches on. Again, next Thursday night at this same time, The March of Time. This is the National Broadcasting Company.